Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday, the 6th of May. Very nice to have you. Hello. How are you? There we go. Did you hear that on the other side? Did you hear that?
I heard it.
Yeah. Wow. Goodness. Good morning, everybody. Welcome. the headphones are now working. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. Very nice to have you with us on this Thursday morning. It is the 6th of May, and it's a Thursday. That's really good news. Let me introduce the panel to you. Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
I'm good, fresh from the media project, and we had a good time this week.
Good. Excellent. Excellent. Good. Spirited discussion, I am sure.
Absolutely.
Counterterrorism expert and best-selling author Malcolm Nance is with us this morning. Good morning,
hey.
Malcolm.
Good morning.
How are you?
It's a great morning outside.
Yeah, it's beautiful. We get some sunshine. It's very nice. Good to be out in the sun. Siena College professor of comparative politics, Vera Acarius Kelly is here. Good morning, Vera. How are you?
Good morning. I'm also feeling pretty good with the sun coming out.
I know. It makes us feel good. And Jim Handler is here, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI and Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration. Good morning, Jim Handler.
Morning, Joe. Beautiful sun. What can I say?
Yes. Well, it's enough, I think. You know, if you got that going for you, we'll just stick with that. We have a lot to talk about this morning. We welcome your letters and we welcome your thoughts on the issues that we will discuss this morning. There are many of them. So we will get started. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org to be a part of the discussion. Just a quick reminder, because we find that sometimes we just have to, you know, tap you on the shoulder and remind you some of the rules. And they're not onerous, but they are rules in the sense that we want you to keep them short and to the point so we can get to as many as possible. And just, you know, double check before you send it so we know what you're trying to say. And one per customer, and I think that's it. Okay, there we go. Let's go to Liz Cheney and talk about this story, which continues to churn and turn. The third most powerful Republican in the House, Liz Cheney, is about to be ousted. She has written an opinion piece in the Washington Post, which I think really lays out her cause quite well. It is basically a plea saying that the GOP is at a turning point and history is watching us this week. She makes the point that in public statements, former President Donald Trump has repeated his claims that the 2020 election was a fraud and was stolen. His message, I am still the rightful president and President Biden is illegitimate. Trump repeats these words now with full knowledge that exactly this type of language provoked violence on January 6th. And as the Justice Department and multiple federal judges have suggested, there is no good reason to believe that Trump's language can provoke violence again. Trump is seeking to unravel critical elements of our Constitution structure that make democracy work. Confidence in the result of elections and the rule of law. No other American president has ever done this. The Republican Party, she says, is at a turning point, and Republicans must decide whether we're going to choose truth and fidelity to the Constitution. In the immediate wake of the violence on January 6th, almost all of us knew the gravity and the cause of what had just happened. We had witnessed it firsthand. So there is much more in this, and I'll probably read a couple more sections as we go, because it is a very powerful piece that she has is writing. And she pretty much, Alan, in my reading of it, is, you know, knows that she's going to be thrown out, but just thinks that we have to take a long, hard look at where we're headed.
Well, look, Liz Cheney has not always been the best representative of the American democracy. There, if one reads the New York Times today, you'll see, I think it was Charles Blow, you'll see a large litany of things she did that weren't that attractive. But right now, is she ever on target? And I'll take it, because there is an absolute logic to the fact that we have a despot who's been trying to take over this country and who really is a potential dictator. his friend, like his friend Putin and the people that he admires, Duterte and all the rest of them. We know who this guy is. Donald Trump is a terror. And if he gets back into office, we'll see that. She's on target. She knows exactly what she's talking about. She's exactly right.
Malcolm Nance.
You know, I can't remember how many times we've actually said this on this program, that we are entering yet another dangerous phase in American history.
Yes.
We literally have an entire political party. And let me ask you a question. If you're Republican, call in and explain this to me. How they are.
Email us, don't call. Go ahead.
Or email, okay.
Email. I don't want to take any calls right now.
Absolutely, flat out are rejecting an American election in which there is no evidence, no evidence. I come from the intelligence community, completely evidence-based organization, all right? There's no evidence that the election was stolen. It's just made up. And they believe that if one man tells them this, that they must first attempt to overthrow American democracy, and then second, literally rally around the destruction of the two-party system in the United States and push the big lie, this great lie that if you're a Republican, and I'm looking at you, Elise Stefanik, you have to be a proud pathological liar, that you must actually believe that the party, no matter what it says, no matter what you see with your own eyes, is telling the truth about everything. And I mean, we have people, even Tucker Carlson went full QAnon the other day, saying that he would no longer refer to the Joe Biden administration by that name because he's not president. And you know, hinting that, you know, it belongs to Kamala Harris or it's part of the, you know, grand Jewish conspiracy. The conservatives have gone insane. I can't even believe that I'm saying that. Way back when, about 30 years ago, I used to be a Republican. I was a Colin Powell Republican. They kicked him out of the party. So now they are the QAnon party, the party of mental illness and pathological lying. And it's an absolute disgrace that more people aren't shouting about this rather than observing this conflagration of what used to be the party of Lincoln.
That well said, Malcolm. Vera.
Well, I'm equally disturbed by developments. I think what we're watching is a delegitimizing of democracy as a political system. And what we see is an effort by this sort of new nationalist, right-wing, populist Republican Party to just continuously stir up socioeconomic vision and a cultural form of right-wing populism that pits the working class against international capitalist systems and then uses immigration, identity, race, and religious elements to segregate people in particular groupings. And what is being done is basically suggest to the American public that democracy is not a good system anymore. So this is a very scary development, because Liz Cheney is somebody who actually speaks on behalf of a principled approach to let the Justice Department pursue a criminal investigation into the January 6th attacks. And what the Republican Party that is now emerging, that we see now, is against fact finding. It does not trust the current political structure or even the idea of democracy. So this is a path on which we are that I would suggest is extremely dangerous for the fundamental principles on which this country is based. I'm also quite concerned about what we observe.
One of the things, Vera, that I don't think, I mean, there's so much to be horrified about here mm-hmm. that I am concerned that we also listening to Kevin McCarthy is the sexism that is going on here to me is quite rampant. So when the men of both Kevin McCarthy and Stephen Scalise say that Liz Cheney is not being humble enough and that she's like the girlfriend rooting for the wrong team when her quarterback is playing in the big game, how is that not sexist?
Well, of course it's sexist, but the idea among sort of this nationalist right-wing populism is also that you use that kind of language to discipline women. So if they speak outside of what you think women should be authorized to comment on, that's what you go after. You delegitimize women based on their appearance, based on their stepping outside of these boundaries that men attempt to draw around Liz Cheney now. You're being made to feel like you're speaking beyond what your party actually endorses. Therefore, you're an outlier and must be disciplined because what you do is not permissible. And those sexist terms that are being used is simply a messaging system to a lot of women to be careful if they don't want to be broadly shamed and attacked for behavior that is perceived to be or messaged to be inconsistent with this new Republican Party.
Right. And then enter Elise Stefanik.
Yes.
So, Jim Handler.
So, let me use that enter Elise Stefanik. You know, I'm struck, I agree with everything the others have said, but I'm really struck by an irony, which is, you know, Cheney, who comes from a tremendously strong conservative background, you know, true Reagan Republican, is now seen as the moderate. Meanwhile, we have Stefanik, who came in 2014 as a moderate, who's, you know, kind of embraced the modern Republican Party or whatever we want to call the Trump Party, and, you know, is now flying. And it just shows that the people who are consistent and profiles and courage are getting heard, and the people who are willing to say whatever they think the public wants to hear are increasing in their popularity. And it's just a scary time because it's, you know, demagoguery is beating out intelligent argument.
Yeah, and Alan, I guess, you know, there also seems to be, and I mean, you have hinted at this, and I think there seems to be this, I mean, even Liz Cheney talks about that this could be a very big win for the, or a win, I don't know if a big win for the Republicans in the taking over the House next year, but you also have to look at it through the, down the long road.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what you're getting at here, Joe.
Well, meaning you can change the, if you change the House, I mean, she's saying that this can have short-term advantage for the Republicans, but long-term you're destroying the party and the country.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And thank you for clarifying that. I appreciate it. There's no question that the Republicans have been eaten from within by a beetle. They're done.
The cicadas are coming.
They are. They have been digested and they've been eaten. They're eating themselves. In the meantime, Joe Biden is doing quite well, over 50%, substantially over 50% in the approval rating, something that Donald Trump never got. You see, because of the gerrymandering and the drawing of districts, that the Republicans indeed may take over the House, but not because they're that popular or because their ideas are that popular, but simply because American politics is filled with chicanery of different kinds, including the way in which we draw our congressional districts. And until that changes, they're going to be a formidable enemy for principles of democracy.
Malcolm?
you know, I don't see how the Republicans think this is going to be a winning formula. But, you know, when you're talking about the fever swamp of the way they believe right now, they believe everything they are doing is a winning formula. They believe that the 2020 election was won. And, you know, so when you consider it from that perspective, which is a little crazy, if I can speak frankly,
Do they really?
I don't know how they think that they're going to engineer a take back. And the only thing that I believe that will really assist them is the very fact that everyone else, the Democratic Party leadership in particular, are not screaming to the high heavens and are just sitting there watching this self-immolation of the Republican Party. But the problem is their flames are going to destroy American democracy. And so I'm quite surprised the counter messaging against this is not being pushed. And this is where Democrats make mistakes. Okay. What they always do is say, we're going to let our good work speak for us. And that's awesome. Excuse me. It's awesome. It's very Christ-like. And granted, Jesus Christ won in the long term, but, you know, on Golgotha, it didn't work out too well for him. So, you know, we are not made of the same ilk, you know. So we have to actually go forward and push not just the agenda that's working right now. Things are going great for the Biden administration, but we have to actually start calling out the other party as broken. We have to start calling the other party as being dangerous to America. We have to stoke our own followers to believe that the 2022 election could literally destroy everything that we have. If they take back the Senate or they take back the House, it's all done. Once
or
again,
both.
We go right back to 2016, and they're set up to put some crazy, whether it's Elise Stefanik or whether it's, you know, Donald Trump again back on the ballot for the presidency in 2024. We've, you know, the messaging has got to be better than, we inoculated all these people.
I have to pause you there because we are out of time. We'll take a break. When we come back on the other side of news, we'll get letters and discuss this more. Panel at WAMC.org. Many letters on this Thursday morning. We'll get to them in just a second. A reminder, you can join us as well and share your thoughts. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Vera Karius-Kelly, Malcolm Nance, and Jim Henler make up the group this morning. All right, let's go to letters. We begin with Russ, who says the Republican Party is closing ranks around nativism and cultural grievance. Their attempt to co-opt the populist mantle has been hopelessly preempted by Biden's working class oriented policy initiatives. The Republican caucus is too divided on economic issues to do much more than support the Trump tax cuts, his only legislative accomplishment, though he did not personally have a hand in the shaping of that legislation. As a result, the majority of independent voters are unlikely to see the Republican Party as friendly to their pocketbooks. Then we go to John. The Republican Party, henceforth to be called the GQP, is not just nationalist, but white nationalist, Christianist extremist. I dislike using the term populist because what we keep calling populist is very demagoguery. We need to start calling it that, demagoguery. We need to start calling these GOP politicians demagogues. We need to start calling things what they are. That from John.
Here.
We go to PJ, who says, please stop using the word conservative to define Trumpists and the loony right, as no conservative supports Trump or QAnon. The brilliant Edmund Burke would never support Trump.
No conservative? I'll bet you're wrong.
That's an interesting point. Let's see. We go to Tom. Colin Powell was the one that perpetuated the real big lie. Iraq had mass weapons of mass destruction. I'm not sure one would be proud of that fact. There is a world where Joe Biden won the election and there was election fraud. Anyone who wants a free democratic society would welcome examining issues with the U.S. elections. There were many Democrats who objected to Trump winning in 2016, and they were not banished from the party. Elise Stefanik has never stated the election was stolen. She clearly laid out the issues in specific states that should be looked at.
Elise Stefanik voted to not certify the election on January 6th, and she supported the insurrection to overthrow the government of the United States and the seditionists and the sedition that's still being occurred, that's occurring right now. That's the only way we can justify what she did, unless she comes right out and pulls a full Lynn Cheney and start saying, I do not support, I believe Joe Biden is the duly elected president of the United States. She can't get off the hook. All of the election fraud that was committed in this election, maybe what did they say, 10, 15 cases, were perpetrated by Republicans. Three in Pennsylvania alone, where they had double voted for dead people, all Republicans. This is the cleanest election we've ever had. But we cannot allow the lie to stand, and we can't allow people to come and say, well, both sides have done it. Look, you can object to an election like we did in 2016. There were irregularities. People were working with foreign governments. But we never said that Donald Trump didn't get elected president. He got more votes. He got more electoral college votes. But for them to come up and say, this government's illegitimate, it didn't happen, we should overthrow the government, which they continue to support, well, that's a completely different story.
And then less of a rant, I would say, you know, just look what's going on. I mean, look at Arizona and their insane attempt to re-examine, he says politely, the vote. I mean, they're doing things like they're looking for bamboo because they think maybe China dumped votes in. They're looking now, they're threatening to start going and asking voters in person, who they voted for, so they can check, which, by the way, is federally illegal and you know, just insane. And, you know, Stefanik has not in any way rejected or criticized those who are doing calling things out. So, you know, when he says they were she's calling out these legitimate challenges. No, these challenges have all been examined. They've all been looked at. The data is there. The data is public. You can look at it yourself.
Well, you know that Stefanik sees her bread and butter, you know, quite clearly. She's going to be the number three person in the U.S. House of Representatives at a very young age.
Yeah.
Now, we don't want to call names, but I can say that is pretty horrible behavior on anybody's part when it comes to defending the American democracy.
Joel writes to us and says, I'm sick of this whimpering about Liz Cheney getting the boot. Tough toenails. Cheney is a staunch Republican in the Reagan mold. Every bit of toxic sociopathic legislation the GOP have come up with in a generation has had her support. Waste no sympathy on her. Kids in cages didn't bother her. Starving kids didn't bother her. Systemic racism doesn't bother her. Mass shootings don't bother her. She stopped short with armed insurrection and the big lie. That's a bar so low, it's used by snails for high jump practice, says Joel.
Well, okay, so that's a very funny letter. But in essence, what I would like to say is also that what's disturbing overall is to watch that when you don't have multiple functioning parties, but, you know, a system where you had two parties and one of them goes off and does something that is anti-systemic, anti-democracy. We can all disagree with Liz Cheney and her, very extremely hostile language during the prior decade against all kinds of policy-related issues. But I think most of us are more deeply concerned about the survival of a democratic structure and the institutions that we have and the kind of commitment we have made to the kind of society we live in. And I think if you just have one party that functions effectively and the only other party that exists is going off and trying to create a parallel shadow structure to overthrow the entire system. That is profoundly disturbing. And that's why I think most of us are paying close attention to what's happening to Cheney.
Norman writes in response, doesn't Liz Cheney deserve a page in Profiles in Courage as she stands for truth against a league of liars? Tom asks this.
Wait, just for a second, Joe. I mean, let's face it. What's happening here is not only the Democrats and the Trumpians, but which is what the Republican Party has become, but it's also something else. It's also a fight within the Republican Party, and the Cheneys and the Bushes are uniting together to rid themselves of what they consider to be a very bad cancer. So it's very important for us to remember that while she may have been on what we consider the wrong side on many things, she is doing the right thing now, and to turn her back on it would be a big mistake.
Tom writes, what does it say about the Republicans that they want to punish Cheney for telling the truth and want to elevate and reward Stefanik for lying? What message does that send our children? Which I think is the exact point Liz Cheney was making in her op-ed piece in the Post. Sarah says, I'm concerned that the moniker The Big Lie is too vague to be an effective title for a counter message to Trump's. Rather, it should be referred to by media as Trump's election lie or the Trump's insurrection lie or Republican lie, something that actually ties this assault on democracy to its perpetrators. We can call the promoters of this falsehood perpetrators. If we are not precise in terminology, we risk co-opting the big lie moniker by Trumpians who will invert the message to their own ends.
Good point.
It's all about the marketing. Let's see.
The framing, yes. It's absolutely important.
Andrew says, can we relax with the fear-mongering? We all know these things are happening, and the way you're discussing these problems is doing nothing more than raising my blood pressure. Is there a way we can fix this? Is there a way to do anything? No? Then let's move on. We already know what's going on, and we already know the insanity of it. So instead of dwelling on the insanity, let's talk about either what we can do about it or talk about other things.
That is a really great, how do you put it, ostrich head in the sand way of looking at the world.
I agree with you.
You know, the entire, it's like saying, look, the city's on fire, but I want to have a cookout. Yeah, go have a cookout. But, you know, there are things out there which literally impact every moment of your life. If we didn't learn that during the Trump administration, then you'll never learn it. This is the fundamentals of how America works. And those fundamentals are under attack. And I'm going to give Liz Cheney her props. She is standing up for America. You know, we all have our political differences with her. I don't like her father. He sent me into a war that killed hundreds of thousands of people. But for her, she is standing up to try at least to make this system work. And you got to keep your head out of the sand here. It's time to, I know we all want to get past and go do our barbecues for coronavirus. And if that you're doing that part, your patriotic part, great. But you know, when there's a storm coming, you don't stay outside without an umbrella.
And what a storm!
Well, but
you know, this is this is one of the greatest. I'm sorry, I'll go very quickly.
We'll get to everybody. I promise.
This is one of the greatest, problems that this country has ever had when it comes to preserving its democracy. We can't look away. You look away, and they win.
We'll go to. I want to go to Vera and then Jim, and then we have to take a break. Go ahead.
So I just wanted to make a very quick comment that I see what the writer discussed also in my classes. In all my political science conversations, the vast majority of students from diverse majors, but also the political science students, are exhausted with conversations about politics, and they're not paying attention again. So I think this is one of those moments where I try to also bring in discussions about how their future might be impacted by the decisions and conversations and developments that we observe now. but they're simply exhausted from the coronavirus shutdown, from all of the losses and the you know, the shrinking in of their personal lives. And it is, I think, in my view, a very dangerous development to not pay attention.
Jim.
Yeah, I'd recommend they get out of politics.
So quickly, what I would recommend is they get into politics. But no, I mean, seriously, I think the writer did make one good point, right? Which is we should be talking more about what people can do about it, about voting, about raising your voices, about getting involved, about participating, not just sitting back and, you know, social media ranting, but really get out there and do things. And I think the more the Democrats can use this to motivate the core of their party, the better off we are. And frankly, I think the progressives need to get into the game because they're so busy fighting against, you know, for more of the good stuff that's happening that they're forgetting they got to fight against this bad stuff for 2 years from now, you know, it all goes away.
We're late for a break, so we will go to that right now. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue our conversation on the other side right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Vera Karius-Kelly, Jim Henler, and Malcolm Nance with us this morning. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. James writes, Vera is right about the long-term damage being done to our democracy. The Republicans are sowing doubt in the rule of law and the electoral process, which are the bedrocks of a democratic society. Joe says, does Dick Cheney still have any pull behind the scenes? Can he pull off any political retributions against people attacking his daughter? Let's see.
I think the answer is not much.
Yes, it seems to be that way.
Well, except that there is, you're right, but there is still a Republican group. And they are the Bushes, and they are the people that the Bushes control, because that's who is being spoken for here. I have no doubt about that. So I think there may be more people than you think, because if you look at the polls and you see how badly Trump does in the electoral polls, that's got to speak to some Republicans doing the right thing, don't you think?
It's a good point, Alan. For the first time, the polling, looking at the recent data, Trump is down to about 30% favorable, which
exactly.
is lower than he was the whole time he was president. But I think even more interesting is in two recent polls, for the first time, when you ask people, are they more tied to the GOP or to Trump, for the first time in 5 years now, I think it is, GOP is at 50% and Trump is below. So the party has really moved to is slowly moving to some stasis there, and it'll be interesting to see what happens.
It's an interesting point you're
making.
You
know, the Republican Party has always been beholden to financial interests. And I think we might see, in the short term at least, a rebellion. I mean, they are directly attacking corporations now, even though many of these corporations had funded Republican efforts for decades. And I wonder whether they're going to worry about sales versus crazy. And if corporations start abandoning the Republican Party and thinking Joe Biden is the center that they need, I think that could hurt them, but not in the short term. I think they don't care anymore. They just want to go full out nuts.
But Malcolm, they have to care. I mean, you know, if they're going to win elections, they got to care. So the reason that I'm even bringing this up right now is that they are in a terrible spot where they're about to lose across the board because of their stupidity. And that is why the Republicans are between a rock and a hard place of that. There's no doubt. They just have no other place to go. If their leaders go somewhere else, they get wrapped around the knuckles by the Trumpians. And so they're going to defend themselves, but not the party.
We got this letter from John. The Democrats have always had a problem understanding when they are in a street fight. They need to get more aggressive. Paul says,
"Wait, Joe, don't you think? Doesn't the panel think that Biden has been striking out. I mean, I've been listening to his comments, and in the beginning it was nicey, 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 and now he's taking them on. He's referring to the mistakes of the Trump administration, and I think we got to give him some credit. Am I just hearing things?
No, I think you're right, Ellen. You know, one that I'm very impressed by is signs that have been going up around the country, because now a lot of the Republicans who have been trying to claim that the American Recovery Act was there, you know, that isn't it great you're getting this money from the government? Signs are going up saying, interesting that so-and-so says that he voted against it. And they're really trying to push very hard in people's districts that they voted against this legislation. So a start in the right direction.
Anyone else? All right. Let's go to this letter, who is praising Malcolm. You go, Malcolm. Perfectly and emphatically said, you're exactly right about the frustration and outrage that more of the country and then the Democratic leadership is not as vocal and outraged about this. So where is the Democratic Party's outrage at what the GOP has become and what they're doing to our country? And why are the Dems content with watching the GOP's internal strife while allowing their lies to go unchallenged and let their messaging grow legs? It's not a foregone conclusion that the GOP will regain Congress, though the Dems act like it is. So glad that Malcolm is on the program, a necessary counterpoint to many panelists who often defend the mamby-pamby Democrats. Ooh.
I can just make a quick comment.
Inter-party
fighting.
You know,
I spent my entire life risking my literal body and life to defend this country, only to find that, you know, in my middle upper age, that we have people here that won't risk theirs to defend the entire process. And a lot of people who, like you said, they just want to move on. They just want to live their lives. Your life may be horribly impacted by this. It was horribly impacted over the last 4 years, but we have 40% of the country that believes that the destruction of American democracy is awesome. And you know what? If I'm going to be putting my life on the line, I'm going to raise my voice, and everyone else should also.
Just look at Putin. Just look at Trump's best friend, Putin, you know, and Pelosi says, every step, you know, everything leads to Putin. I think that's true. And if you accept that, and if you accept the fact that that's what Trump wanted, and that that's what he was doing, then this is the most dangerous time we've ever faced.
Kathleen writes, remember Swing Left, one of the groups that helped flip the House blue in 2018? They ousted John Faso with assistance from members of Swing Left chapters in New York State, Connecticut, and Massachusetts. Certainly Stefana can be defeated by well-organized progressive groups. What does Alan think?
Well, Alan thinks it's not the same. You know, look, I remember that ousting of Faso. And it did, of course, take a lot of work on a lot of people's parts. But there are a lot of Republicans up there. Could she be defeated? She could. But I doubt it. It's going to be a hard lift to be able to do it. Malcolm, you live in our district, don't you?
No, I'm actually in New York 19. But I was here for the Faso Fridays they were holding in Kinderhook, which is really close to my house. And the mobilization on that was incredible. I mean, every Friday, they put his office under siege, and he never came to that office. You know, maybe it's time to do that in Stefanik's district. You know, you got to look out for, the pro-Trumper, vanilla ISIS convoys that will come and support her. But you got to show rejection of her as an individual representative. Sure.
And Delgado proves that, that some of the more conservative parts of New York might be accessible, but it takes a lot of work.
All right.
Yeah, that's true. I never thought Delgado would win, but he did.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We have many other items to discuss. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We will be back right after this. Good morning and welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. 5 minutes past 10 o'clock, and we welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. Just want to get to a few more letters on what we were talking about in our first hour, and then we'll move on to other subjects. So we go to Harleen, who says the coming storm is the end of democracy, not only here in the United States, but in the world. China is on the rise. They've destroyed democracy in Hong Kong. Next, we'll threaten Taiwan. They have the Belt and Road, which is extending their influence in Africa, Asia, and South America. Their economy is expected to soon overtake the United States. They know the Trumpers are dismantling all aspects of government. They are not a threat, as they have no idea what they're doing. Moreover, the Trumpers are hated all over the world. Vera, would you like to tackle that one?
Well, okay. So my comment on that is that to outsiders, China always looks incredibly strong and powerful, but there are a lot of internal divisions in China. There are a lot of environmental activists and political activists that are challenging the system domestically. While mostly repressed, there are certainly not unified Chinese positions. So the kinds of things that are weakening and reshaping many countries in the world are also affecting China. So I do see a rise of the power of China, especially through their economically based foreign policy. However, I would also point to significant domestic and internal problems in China. So I don't quite buy the argument that it's a monolithic block that is so powerful that all of us will be dominated by it.
Well, I don't like to disagree with Vera, and I think she's right about it not being monolithic. But I think right now the government has significant control in China and is moving with a very aggressive policy of internationalization. And they will be to us in the already almost what Russia was during the Cold War. I mean, they will be the one that's opposing us in small countries. They're going to be the ones that are fighting for economic influence. So I do think we're going to see significant impact of what's happening in China. And I think the Trump administration essentially empowered that. They spent 4 years making China great.
And don't you think it's interesting that we see currently emerging critique against the Biden administration's positioning on Taiwan, because I think the Biden administration is trying to challenge the sort of, you know, regional foreign policy approaches of China, but there is sort of a hard pushback and how dangerous it is to challenge China. I find it very interesting that, you know, there is a clear division within the country, especially among Democrats, on how to actually reposition the United States towards China. And is a policy debate that needs to happen still. Right, Jim?
No, absolutely. And, you know, they're rapidly becoming both our, you know, one of our most significant trading partners. So you've sort of got business who are very worried about how we interact with China, at the same time that you have this international competition, which, frankly, at the moment, I would not say we are winning.
You're quite right. And you're quite right. And this country has a very dangerous road, if I'm not mistaking it. The Chinese still are incredibly important to our business interests, and yet they keep testing us.
Well, that's worked, right? It's worked to test the United States and to challenge and to push. That is a strategy that has worked, especially also during the Trump administration.
Let's go to this letter from Linda. This is for Linda. I'm sorry. This is for Alan and Malcolm from Linda. Alan, I am one of those Republicans who is so far removed from 45 and the folks who attacked my Capitol, and there are hundreds like me. Malcolm, don't lump all Republicans together. All right. So that's, there you go.
Well, good. Congratulations. Of course, I'm going to say what you know you're going to hate, which is the polling doesn't show it. And shows you remarkable numbers of people in the Republic, the former Republican Party, if we want to refer to it that way, who are sticking with Trump. I mean, the guy is revulsion itself, and yet he does have so many people. Now, congratulations to you. I think it's great that you're thinking for yourself and that you've disengaged, but that doesn't seem to be the case.
Russ asks, what's going to happen to the Republican Party when Donald Trump eventually drops dead?
Yeah, it's a very good question. It's a very good question.
Yeah, well.
Of course, he has the best health care that money can buy. We saw that when he got to the COVID. And he'll be with us for a certain amount of time, I suppose. And I always believe what he says, by the way. I know he's a lying liar, but he says he's going to run again. And I think he is going to run again.
I think next Trump is coming. And there are people positioning themselves for that job. Josh Hawley is a good example. DeSantis in Florida. And I think they're more dangerous than Trump. And what they will run on is Trumpist ideology, which is they will continue his insane rantings. And then, you know, they may get elected. The trick now is to hold on to his followers if he doesn't go back into major politics. And they're all setting themselves up for this.
All right. Keith writes, Stefanik is scheduled to go on Steve Bannon's War Room podcast later today. Steve Bannon was arrested last year for stealing from Trump supporters with his Build the Wall grift. They arrested Bannon on a Chinese billionaire's yacht in the Long Island Sound. Isn't the GOP trying to rebrand themselves as the working class party? Nothing says working class like a Harvard grad going on a podcast where the host was arrested on a Chinese billionaire's yacht for stealing from MAGA supporters. Have you ever seen anything like this before? You think that Bannon would be too toxic for a politician, but Stefanik is going there to get his endorsement.
Well, the other comment I have to say, Hawley, who was just mentioned, of course, has a degree from Yale. So one wonders if Yale graduates and Harvard graduates in the Republican Party's, you know, branch or direction, those that are the Trump supporters, are they no longer valuing the high level of education they have received? Or does it mean that their education is just a stepping stone towards personal fulfillment and an interest in power and wealth? I mean, one wonders how these types of people use their elite, high-level, privileged education, not for service, but self-enrichment or self-promotion.
Look, the entire German hierarchy bowed to Adolf Hitler, who was a corporal and a failed painter. So these people are bowing to power, and they don't care about their education. They don't care about anything other than getting the next step up the ladder. They saw Trump do what he did, and they want to be part of that because it makes them money. And they will step and insult on all these rubes all they want, so long as they keep getting the votes. And, you know, and if that takes burning down the United States, I suspect they will.
So that just affirms our prior argument that it's an extremely dangerous period where people are so interested in their self-promotion that they are fine with destroying the democratic principles of this country.
Jim?
I certainly agree with that, Vera. I was just going to defend that not all Yellies are the same.
Says
an alum of the class of 78.
You know, Vera, that's an... You know, Vera, that's an interesting point that was made about Germany and whether or not they've learned their lesson. I mean, if you took all the fettering off, do you think, Vera, as a real expert on Germany and who we depend on, do you think that there's still an underlayment of the good old days lying there?
My comment is to, you know, I don't find the comparisons to Nazi Germany very convincing because I think we had, you know, we had an entirely different economic reality at the time. We also didn't have everybody falling in line. We had a different technological environment, and we didn't have social media and messaging the way we have today. So I don't think it's quite as easy to establish those parallels. And I do think that we have a significant number of business people and entrepreneurs who that completely understand in this country what a dangerous path it is that the new Republican Party is pursuing. And I think we will see significant pushback in terms of limitations to donations by corporations to that kind of a party. So I'm cautious about establishing parallels to the rise of Nazism. I really am.
Even with not. Trump and okay, go ahead, Malcolm. You're with me. Go ahead.
No, I was just punching that out there. I'm not. I just watched 5 years. I was deeply involved in what was going on. And maybe from an academic's perspective, that may be true, but I literally spent the last 5 years shouting and trying to defend democracy. I'm writing a book right now about right-wing extremists. These people are neo-Nazis. They're fascist. They are pro-authoritarian. And you might say, well, that's just the extreme. The problem is the extreme is now the mainstream. Granted, there aren't exact parallels. There never will be. But I'll tell you right now, the United States is closer to, supporters like, the silver shirts in America first in 1940 and the German-American Bund than they ever were.
All right. We're going to move on to other topics. There's a lot to get to, and we have about a half hour with each other, so let's do it. So we talked about this story yesterday, but I'm interested in talking about some of the aftershocks, and especially with Jim here. Facebook's suspension of Donald Trump will continue for now, the company announced yesterday, but it still has not resolved the central problem that Trump has created for social media platforms and, by extension, American democracy. The problem is that Trump lies almost constantly, unlike many other politicians, including other recent presidents from both parties. He continues to make false statements even after other people have documented their falseness. This behavior undermines the healthy functioning of American democracy, particularly because Trump has such a large following. But Facebook has decided that the health of American democracy isn't the problem. And the company justified its suspension of Trump in January, not based on his lies, but instead on his incitement of violence before and during the January 6th attack on the Capitol by his supporters. The issue here isn't that the enduring philosophical question of what constitutes truth. It's whether Facebook is willing to tolerate obvious and influential lies. So far, the company has decided that it is. It has drawn a line somewhere between blatant untruths and incitement to violence. Jim, I'm interested in your perspective on this.
Yeah, so it's an interesting story in a lot of ways. So to give a little bit of background, Joe, I don't think this was covered in quite as much detail yesterday. The Facebook Oversight Board was set up by Facebook because essentially people were saying Facebook was making all its decisions based on financial input. So again, having Trump there makes them a lot of money. There's no question about that. So they set up this board to try to get out of being having the responsibility for making some of these decisions, but also for being able to say, look, we have ethicists who are involved. The board is an interesting group. I won't go into the details, but, here's a cute factoid. Their budget is higher than the budget of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Oh, that is
several,
cute.
By a number of million dollars. It's a very powerful group. And basically, there's kind of a push shove. This group is trying to say to Facebook, look, we'll make these individual decisions, but you got to create some policies. And Facebook is saying, we really don't want to create these policies because when we do, we lose lose paying people. So the Trump case has become sort of the outstanding case on that. And, it's very interesting because if you look at social media, most of the largest social media tend to have more Democrats than Republicans, some of them by as much as 20%, Instagram, some by only a little bit. Facebook is almost exactly 50-50, and is Facebook and YouTube, which are the two that are just the most used, both tend to be very even. So, you know, it's sort of, they're trying very hard to focus on this line, and it gets really hard because you have to deal with misinformation, disinformation, what is lying, all these things. But the one that's obvious is, you know, the minute it's incitement for violence, you can say that violates the law, we're kicking you off. The question is what counts as incitement? And that's been something the courts have been fighting on for a long time. I've been saying for a long time now, what we really need is not to let these companies make their own decisions, but we really need some significant policy making that says these are the rules that will govern these kind of entities. And the same way we did for television, the same way we did before that for radio, the same way we did before that for newspapers, there are laws about what they can and can't do and can and can't say. And we don't have that for social media. And it's causing tremendous problems, including some of this rise of Trumpism, which many of us feel couldn't have happened without that social media impact.
So is this short term or long term as far as this particular suspension? Where does it go from here and how do you see
well,
that playing
it goes
out?
On, it goes on for about another 6 months, I believe, is what the board ruled. And then a decision there. The board is asking Facebook to make the decision. Facebook is asking the board to make the decision. So we'll see what happens. I think Facebook is sort of hoping that if they keep doing it a little at a time, sooner or later it'll go away. And probably the most interesting thing about this is a lot of people believe you can't win a modern election without being able to dominate some of the things that happen in Facebook, particularly in some of the swing states. So it's unclear that Trump being on Facebook equals the Trumpists advertising and doing the same thing on Facebook, but it's being held up as if it is.
So I know you just explained this, but I'm just I apologize for being dense. But so what is the independence between this board and Facebook?
So the people on the board are not technically Facebook employees. They're chosen through a mechanism that's a combination of Facebook and the board itself making decisions. It includes a lot of people who've been involved in a lot of these ethical decisions for a long time. It includes people who are judges and, you know, have legal backgrounds. So it's a very interesting group. But by and large, you know, Facebook wants this group to be looking at the policies, and this group wants Facebook to really make some rules and live by them and to stop sort of throwing all these cases to the board. So the board was really supposed to be overseeing things like, as Facebook deploys certain kinds of technology, are they making the right decisions? But also much bigger things. So, for example, if China says to Facebook, you can't be in our country unless you do X, Y, Z, Facebook has to decide whether to do it or not. That's a big financial decision, but the board can help them by also saying, no, you know, you don't want to go there. That's supporting an authoritarian government or whatever.
So we remain. It remains to be seen. And what impact will this have on the same action that's being taken by Twitter, for example?
It probably won't. Twitter has made, you know, Twitter announced a permanent ban, and it's very unlikely they're ever going to go back on it. Facebook has been waffling the whole time, and by the way, they're famous for waffling. They're trying to please both the right wing and the left wing because, again, both of those put a lot of money into their platform.
Anyone else in this?
Yes. You dance with the one who brought you, right? So even though the board, there's some very impressive people on the board, they know who appointed them. And in a way, didn't they punk out? I mean, you know, I'm sure that the people who are running Facebook understand that. But by saying, you make the decision, you know, they basically bailed.
You know, Alan, yes and no. I mean, on one hand, pretty much everyone I was listening to on the media was saying, you know, the board is going to give it back, you know, let Trump go back on. And I never believed they would let Trump go back on. But it wasn't clear to me that they had the power to say, let's put in a permanent suspension. They could have recommended it. But, you know, again, I think when you look at the real details, I'm not quite sure what you just said is right, but I think the gist of what you said is right. They're, both sides are trying to make the other one make a hard decision.
All right, let's move on. We'll go to one more story here before we have to take a break at the bottom of the hour. And we go to, I'm trying to think of the one that would best fit into the time that we have. So let's go to the federal judge vacating the CDC's nationwide eviction moratorium. A federal judge in Washington on Wednesday ruled that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention overstepped its legal authority by issuing a nationwide eviction moratorium, a ruling that could affect millions of struggling Americans. It was a 20-page order where a U.S. district judge vacated the CDC order, first put in place during the coronavirus pandemic under the Trump administration and now set to expire June 30th. It is the role of the political branches and not the courts to assess the merits of policy measures designed to combat the spread, even during a global pandemic, the order states. The question for the court is a narrow one. Does the Public Health Service Act grant the CDC the legal authority to impose a nationwide eviction moratorium? It does not. Alan.
What do we know about the judge?
The judge.
Trump appointed.
I'm sorry?
It's a Trump-appointed judge.
Dabney Friedrich.
Well, there you go. Any way to throw a hand grenade into things, there it is. And we know one last thing. We know that judges are politicians. They are. You know, three judges look at a law and they say, two of them say one thing and the other one says something else. You know, they are human beings and they come from a particular place. I'm sorry, Vera, go ahead.
No, I mean, Alan, I just wanted to say also, I think in addition to asking about the judge and sort of maybe that positioning, it's also important to recognize that a lot of landlords and property owners have consistently challenged the CDC's influence and order over the eviction moratorium. They've pushed back very hard for the past, I think, year and a half. And so this actually doesn't surprise me at all, because this is a question of, you know, how important is or how powerful is the Public Health Service Act now in contrast to actually state-based decisions related to home ownership, property management. I mean, these are questions that are hard to decide on a national level permanently. And at some point, it probably does make sense to revisit and look at how many American families could be faced by potential eviction in the coming summer versus, you know, smaller landlords or property owners, how are they affected by this order? So I think this is also something where states might need to really step up and reflect on their own regional impact on those kinds of decisions. Mm. So I'm not entirely surprised by what happened here.
But it'll be interesting to see what the states do. And also, of course, mm-hmm. what these people do when they are forced, if they do have to be evicted.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happens? And what are the choices and what are the options there? Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We have a wonderful panel, Alan Chartok, Vera Karius-Kelly, Jim Hendler, and Malcolm Nance all with us. We welcome your letters as always, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. This will be the last call on those as we have our last few moments together on this Thursday afternoon. So we ask you to keep them short and to the point. But you can certainly send them on to panel@wamc.org. We will continue our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel. I'm Joe Donahue. Alan Chartok, Vera Karius-Kelly, Jim Hendler, and Malcolm Nance make up the panel this morning. We have some letters. We'll go to those, and then we'll move on to our final topics in our last 15 minutes or so on this Thursday morning. So far, let's see. Jill says it is better. It Take two. Is it better as a Dem to live by values and delete Facebook for this tolerance of right-wing extremism, or does that tip the scales more to Republicans being catered to because they could become larger than 50% of the users?
So it's an interesting question because, you know, the conservatives are threatening to leave because it's too liberal. The liberals are threatening to leave because it's too conservative. And actually, nobody's leaving because, frankly, they mostly are using it to communicate with their family and friends and not really to do politics at all. It's just that the advertising on the side affects the politics. There are a subset of users, and it's not a small subset, on both sides who do use it for politics. But again, you know, it's a very interesting environment. I'm more worried. I'm sure Malcolm could weigh in on this. You know, some of the things that are growing on the right wing side, the supremacist side, to create their own social media and things like that is much scarier. And you know, I don't think we're really in danger of Facebook becoming taken over, but I'm much more worried about what's going on with people leaving Facebook and going to these information bubbles where there is no control.
Malcolm?
Yeah, and forums like Gab and Telegram, which I monitor, Parler, they're not actually very successful. And this is, to a certain extent, it actually takes away some of the intelligence that we gained on some of these extremists, because you can actually watch trends. You can see what really crazy ideas are moving forward if you read their communications. But for the most part, I like the idea of deplatforming them, because as those channels, which are privately owned, find that someone takes action or they coordinate something, they'll find out that their existence is really based on other chat, you know, other private companies that relay that information. So there's a ways to go, but I'm actually in favor of I would rather not them communicate sedition than to allow them, you know, let them get on a bus and drive to their allies and conspire in private where the FBI can get at them properly.
So Malcolm mentioned Telegram, and I have to say there's a really interesting story related to Telegram, which was the most powerful platform once used by international youth pro-democracy movements to organize. For example, Telegram was instrumental in the Iranian young people's 2009 Green Revolution against the Islamic regime. Telegram was an incredibly powerful way of organizing anti-repressive, anti-authoritarian regime activism and protests. And then Telegram was taken over by such regimes, such as the Islamic Republic, and has now been transitioned into sort of this preferential platform for ultra right-wing nationalist groups, which is kind of a, you know, it was kind of a shocking development for a lot of young people around the world that really relied on Telegram to organize against repressors.
Interesting. In 2011, I was living in the United Arab Emirates, and I watched firsthand the social media revolution, right? The Twitter and Facebook. Mm-hmm. In the revolutions in Libya, Egypt, Syria. And within a year, even in the country I was living in, which is pretty repressive on social media, within a year, those governments had completely hijacked social media and had weaponized them to actually hunt down these people and to, you know, push falsely all these memes. So, you know, every social media platform is a two-sided sword, depending on what the company allows.
Alan?
Well, I'm listening with great fascination to what everybody has to say here. It is something that we are probably not going to solve on the radio this morning. And I think it is something that the power of the social media is just extraordinary. So I'm just watching.
Power and scale. But, you know, one thing the people listening can do is start letting their politicians know that they should pay attention to this and not just let the companies fight it out by themselves.
How so? What do you want them to do?
Regulatory policy needs to be the companies are asking for regulatory policy, Alan. I mean, it's not like they're saying don't regulate us. It's just the opposite. They're saying we need some clearer rules about what is, you know, what crosses the boundaries so that we can defend ourselves. You know, every time they do one of these things, they're taken to court. They're being sued by every conservative group in the country over the Trump suspensions. They're being sued by all the left wing groups over some other things. And, you know, they'd really like not to be paying all those legal fees, or at least to know what the chances are they're going to win by having some laws that dictate. Now, frankly, they're getting away with a lot of this by saying, you know, we're allowed to do whatever we want, but that's what's causing the problem for the rest of us as a society. So something needs to happen in this space. And a lot of people know that. The problem is it's a complex issue, and the politicians would much rather punt, because these big tech companies now include six of the biggest companies in the entire world. Well, the U.S. companies are six of the top 10, I believe, maybe only five now. The Chinese have the other five. But these companies currently have more money than most national governments by a significant amount. And they, you know, really are impacting life around the world, and we really have to be paying attention to it and thinking about it from a policy issue.
But how long will this go on? In other words, we've heard this kind of talk before. Something needs to happen. They'll have to do something. They're scared to death, obviously, because they don't want to get told what to do. On the other hand, you say they do want to be told what to do, but then we get into the particulars of what that something might be.
Well, so, Alan, you know, again, I always use the analogy of television, where when television was up and coming, it was a wild, wild west. A lot of things were being done, like subliminal advertising, that the government stepped in and said, we have to do something about this. And they put laws in place. So it's a regulated industry. It's not heavily regulated in some ways. It is heavily regulated in others. You know, there are words you can't say on television. And, you know, we can argue about the regulation, but by and large, nobody is arguing that we should unregulate all interactions on television, make libel and slander just fine and all of those sorts of things. So political advertising, you have to say who the advertiser is. You don't on social media, right? Things like that. So again, it's not that I'm arguing for controlling the speech. What I'm arguing is the platforms need to be looked at more carefully and analyzed in terms of their scale and impact, in terms of, you know, what they can do, and then figure out what are the regulations. Just like toxic air gets regulated, toxic words need to be regulated too.
And when that happens, you'll be sure to get back to me?
Yes. And of course, if the government passes the rules, we get deeply into First Amendment rights, but, you know, which is part of why the government is letting the companies do it themselves. But, you know, again, we can limit First Amendment when we do it carefully and within certain rules, or we could even just make these companies play by the current existing rules, right? They don't even have to do that at the moment because they're exempted. So there are ways we could go.
Well, I'm glad we have you, because you're telling me stuff that I really do need to know, but it looks a little indefinite to me as of now.
You know, what I'd say is there's bipartisan support for the idea that something needs to change, and there's absolutely no consensus on what that is and how.
Exactly.
All right, we have 3 minutes left. Let's spend it on Scottish independence. There is an election today, and Scotland is going to the polls in a vote that could eventually lead to a truly historic event, the crack-up of the United Kingdom. The independence movement has gained momentum in the wake of Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Brexit, and the pandemic has further encouraged the idea that Scotland might be better off going its own way, with policies determined in Edinburgh viewed more favorably by Scots than those pronounced at Westminster. As a result, the Scottish National Party, led by a popular First Minister of Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon, is expected to perform well in Thursday's vote for seats in the regional parliament, with pro-independence parties winning a solid majority of the 129 seats. The talk shows, political magazines, and news columns in Britain are full of speculation about a looming breakup. Vera, I'll go to you on this first. They tried this several years, even before Brexit. It was not successful, and now with Brexit, they're trying it again.
Yep, and I think it may actually work a little bit more this time, because Prime Minister Johnson is extremely unpopular in Scotland. He sounds like an elitist, arrogant Englander to the Scottish population. The Scottish population has felt deeply frustrated with the fact that they have experienced a democratic deficit. That's what we call in academic language the idea that 8% of the British population is Scottish, and they felt their vote has not counted and shifted important decisions at the center of power in London, which is why the Scottish population is, you know, increasingly anti-Brexit in the recent elections, and that percentage might increase, and also the sense, because the Scots have been ignored in terms of their particular needs related to fishing rights and their desire to be part of the European Union. That all is deeply emotional in terms of a sense of independence linked to economic policies that they would prefer. So there is quite a chance, in my view, that Scotland will take a big step towards a future independence referendum.
Alan?
And what will happen, Vera, as long as you've got the floor, I'm fascinated. What will happen if there is a pro-independence vote? What would you expect to see?
Well, I think it'll be quite a process to work through that, because what Johnson is trying to do is simply ignore what is happening and developing and bubbling up in the Scottish regions. And by not agreeing to or discussing a referendum, he could just delay it for quite a while, hoping for economic realities to improve. So this will be a long game. I don't think we will see an immediate referendum for independence, just because Johnson could dig in his heels and not respond. So Johnson is hoping for internal divisions between this new Scottish ALBA party and the Scottish National Party, so the two different leaders within the Scottish independence movement. And he's really hoping for internal dissent in Scotland to weaken the longer-term Scottish independence movement. So this is for somebody like me from Europe, this is exciting to watch, to see whether we see this referendum emerging for Scotland. And then secondarily, that, of course, also sends a message to Northern Ireland. So this could be the beginning of the falling apart of what is left of the British Empire.
We are out of time, so we will end there. My thanks to everyone this morning. We'll be right back with the Congressional Quarter.